If you have your Bibles, turn to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. And last week we looked at the first little bit of Daniel chapter 2. And this evening I'm going to try to do something that you all have never seen me do before. I'm going to try to cover 30 verses in one message. And you didn't think I could do it, but we're going to see if I can do it. We're going to try to cover 30 verses in one message, but we're in Daniel chapter 2, and last week we looked at the first 18 verses of Daniel 2, and so just by way of reminder, in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has this very confusing dream, and the dream causes some anxiety for him to the point where he can't sleep the rest of the night. It says that his sleep break from him, or fled from him. He couldn't sleep. And so he called in what I call the magic council, which is the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans. And these are groups of people who would claim some supernatural or extraordinary level of power, whether through mysticism or through divination or through, you know, astrology, you know, deciphering the stars, communing with, you know, the spirits, that sort of thing. And so he calls them all in and he says, "Hey, I had this really weird dream. I want you to tell me what it means." And they said, "Oh, king, of course, you know, tell us the dream and we'll tell you what it means." And he goes, "No, I want you to prove to me that you really have the power that you claim to have. I want you to tell me my dream, and I want you to tell me what it means." "Oh, king, we can't do that. No one's ever been able to do that. Just tell us the dream, and we'll tell you what it means." And he says, "No, you have to tell me my dream. You have to tell me what it means, and if you don't, I'm going to kill all of you." Well, this magic council, they feel very much backed into a corner, and so they get a little angry with the king, and they say, "Look, king, what you're asking us to do is ridiculous. No king in the history of everdom has ever asked anybody to do this. It can't be done. Only the gods can do that. And the gods, they don't commune with people like us." I believe that was verse 11. Yes, verse 11. He says, "It's a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." "Hey, king, look, what you're asking us to do is ridiculous. No one's ever asked anybody to do this. It can't be done. Only the gods can do this, and they don't commune with us. They don't dwell with flesh." And so to that, in response to that, the king gets really angry, right? And he says, "Y'all are a bunch of fakers, and I'm going to wipe all of you out." And so he gives the decree to wipe them all out. And the problem is that decree would include the faithful four, right? Daniel, Mishael, Hananiah, and Azariah. And so Arioch, the captain of the guard, he goes to carry out this command from the king to kill them all. And Daniel says, "Hey, what's going on here? Why is the king commanding to wipe us all out? And why is he in such a hurry to have it accomplished?" And so Arioch explains the whole situation. And Daniel goes, and we read in verse 16, "He desired of the king that he would give him time, and that he would show the king the interpretation." And so Daniel goes to the king and says, "Look, king, please give me some time to pray to my God. And it might be that my God would show mercy by showing me the dream and the interpretation." But it's very interesting that Daniel specifically says, "I'm going to commune with my God, and my God may show me mercy by showing me the dream and the interpretation." And so Daniel doesn't claim any sort of supernatural ability. He says, "I will ask my God, and my God may show mercy by revealing it to me." And so even on that point, Daniel stands out from the rest of the magic council. But we're going to see that even more today. And so the king grants him the time. Daniel goes to his house, and he tells Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, kind of the scoop, right? What's going on? And they all go to the Lord in prayer. And then we read in verse 19, we read it last week and we're going to pick up there today. We read in verse 19, "Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision." then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And so the use of the phrase night vision, it doesn't mean infrared headgear that lets him see in the dark. That's a different kind of night vision. Nor does it necessarily mean that Daniel was asleep and dreaming. The use of the phrase in other passages indicates almost this meditative trance sort of thing. And so the implication was that Daniel was up way late praying to God, asking for mercy, asking for the dream and the interpretation. And he's praying about it. And while he's praying about it, God directly intervenes and comes to him and shows him both the dream and the meaning. And so this paints a very interesting contrast between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. You know, Nebuchadnezzar was up late worrying because his gods were far away. We see that in verse 11 when the magic council says only the gods can do this and they don't dwell with flesh. And so Nebuchadnezzar is up late worrying because his gods are far away, but Daniel is up late because his God is right there with him, and they are communing together. And so the secret is revealed to Daniel, and Daniel immediately blesses God. Lord, thank you for showing me mercy by showing me this dream and its interpretation. It says, Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his." And so Daniel immediately praises the Lord. This is the first of many occasions that we're going to see. And Daniel does this because he recognizes that what had happened here was not his power or his strength or even his virtue as a leader, but rather this is purely an act of God's sovereignty and goodness in the life of Daniel and his friends. And so Daniel first praises God for who he is, and then he's going to praise God for what he's done. And when it comes to our prayers to the Lord, this is a really good model. You know, sometimes we like to make our prayers to the Lord simply about us and what we want from him. Lord, please give me this. Lord, please give me that. Lord, please help this person. Lord, please help that person. And so often we go to the Lord with a laundry list of things we want from him. But it's very important when we talk to the Lord to start by thanking him for who he is, and by thanking him for what he's done for us, and by thanking him for his promises to us. And so I don't know if you all have a prayer journal. I talk about mine a good bit, and I'm happy to show you mine sometime. It's not some big secret. But the first section of my prayer journal is the praise section. And I have it split into three categories. Who is God? What has he done for me? And what are his promises to me? And we see that Daniel follows this model, at least on the first two points. And so he starts by praising God for who he is. He is wise and he is mighty. He says wisdom and might are his. And then he praises the Lord for what he's done. He says, he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. David talks about this as well in Psalm 139, verses 7 through, I think it's 12, where he says, "Whither shall I flee from thy spirit? Whither shall I go from thy presence?" He says, "If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I descend to hell, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning, dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me," he says, "even the night shineth as the day." He says, "the darkness and the light are both alike to thee." I'm misquoting that. I apologize. I'm not good when I'm trying to quote memory on the spot. But it says, he knows what's in the darkness. Even the darkness cannot hide from him. And it says, and the light dwelleth with him. And when we get to John, John is going to take that analogy one step further and say light doesn't just dwell with him. He is the light, right? And we see that in John chapter 1. I'm going to mess that up again. And when I mess it up again, Just know which one I'm talking about. But Daniel, he says that God knows what's in the darkness. He says the light is with him. And so he says, I thank thee and praise thee, O God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me what we desired of thee, for thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. And so Daniel praises the Lord for who he is, and Daniel praises the Lord for what he's done. And in that prayer of thanks for what God has done, Daniel hints at the meaning of the dream. And in the church, we often talk about the value of praying God's word back to him, and essentially that's what Daniel's doing. And so Daniel is essentially praying back to God the interpretation and the meaning of this dream. And Daniel recognizes that God is a revealer, and so God has revealed something both to Nebuchadnezzar and to Daniel, and that would be the dream, but God has also revealed the interpretation to Daniel, and so Daniel is thanking God for his revelation. That's why he says, you have given me wisdom and might. You've made known unto me what we asked of you. And so, so I said that Daniel kind of hints a little bit at the interpretation of the dream through his prayer of thanks. And so look at some of the verbs that he uses. He says that God changes times and seasons. He removes kings. He sets up kings. He gives wisdom and knowledge. He reveals and he knows, right? And so Daniel thanks the Lord for those things. And those verbs kind of address the meaning of the dream, which we know is about some of the various empires of the world. And so we're gonna get to that. But one application of this prayer, specifically verse 21, where Daniel praises the Lord that he is sovereignly in control over the political scheme of the world, right? It says that he changes the times and seasons. He removes the kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding, right? You know, God has allowed the presidents to be in office that they are. And I think part of it is that, you know, now that I'm a little bit older, I think I'm just more acutely aware of the political division that exists in our country. Like, I don't necessarily know that it has kicked up a notch as much as I'm just more acutely aware of it. Because, I mean, even 100 years ago, you know, we had people that were taking shots at presidents over disagreements. I was born in the first half of Bill Clinton's first term. And so I was too young to remember when he was elected to his second term. But I do remember vividly when Bush Jr. was elected to his first term. And then I think I was ninth grade when Obama was elected the first time. But, you know, people are often very polarizing in their views of the political landscape of the day. And so they often feel very strongly about the president and about his administration. And, you know, those who are in favor of the president are very strongly in favor of the president. And those who are not in favor of the president are very strongly not in favor of the president. And we see that. We've seen that all throughout history. But we need to understand from verse 21 that God has allowed the presidents to be in office that are in office. And so when Barack Obama got elected to office, that wasn't a mistake. And when Donald Trump got elected to office the first time, that wasn't a mistake. And when Joe Biden got elected to office, at least on God's part, that wasn't a mistake. And when Donald Trump got elected a second time to president, that wasn't a mistake. And we're reminded from Proverbs 21, it says the king's heart, or in our case, the president's heart, Donald Trump is not the king. He says, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, and as the rivers of water, he turneth it whithersoever he will. Proverbs 19, verse 21 says, there are many devices in a man's heart, nevertheless the counsel of the Lord, that shall stand. Psalm 33, 10 and 11, it says, the Lord bringeth the counsel of the heathen to naught, or to nothing. He maketh the devices of the people, or the schemes of the people, of none effect. It says, the counsel of the Lord standeth forever, and the thoughts of his hearts to all generations. So we need to understand that, we do have responsibility when it comes to the politics of the land, but we need to realize that at the end of the day, the Lord has allowed the people to rise to power that have, and God's plans are going to be accomplished. And so that doesn't mean that we just sit back and roll with the punches. We do have a responsibility, but at the end of the day, that we need to realize that God is the one that sets up kings, and God is the one that removes kings. God is the one that changes the times and seasons, and God is the one that gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those that know understanding. And so Daniel rightly recognizes in verses 21, 22, and 23, he rightly recognizes that God is the giver of all power, possessions, and positions. And so he goes, and he tells this to Arioch. Verse 24, it says, then Daniel went in unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. This would be both the magic council and the faithful four, as I call them. It says, he went to Arioch, and he said thus unto him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon, bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. And so he says, hey, Arioch, you can belay the order to kill us all. I can do what the king is asking for. And so Arioch, of course, he's excited about this. And so he goes. It says, then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. And just a little bit of history, because I just finished writing a paper about this. Notice he says the captives of Judah and not the captives of Israel. Just keep in mind, and I think I talked about this the first week we looked at this. This is right at the end of the divided kingdom. And so following the death of Solomon, his son Rehoboam contracted this really nasty disease called Rehoboam syndrome, where he listened to his friends instead of his father's counselors. And that really didn't pan out well for him. You all know Dr. Peart. I just call him Harry. You all know Harry, and he does something really cool. Whenever his kids are facing like a really big decision, he says, okay, here's what you need to do. You need to go, and you need to ask 10 people who are at least 10 years older than you what they think you should do. And whatever the consensus is, do that. All right, you're thinking about dropping out of college. Go ask 10 people who are 10 years older than you, should I drop out of college? And whatever they say, do that. Well, Rehoboam didn't do that. And he contracted Rehoboam syndrome. He listened to his friends. And so what ended up happening is that 10 of the tribes rebelled against him, and they seceded from the union, if you will, and they made Jeroboam their king, the king of Israel in Samaria. Meanwhile, Judah and Benjamin stayed with Rehoboam as the king of Judah in Israel, Jerusalem, and the northern kingdom, which was the kingdom of Israel, they just had one bad king after the next, and they ended up getting taken captive by Assyria in like the 720s during the reign of Hezekiah. But because Hezekiah was a good king and followed the Lord, he was spared and he was able to defeat Sennacherib with the Lord's help. And then after Hezekiah came Manasseh, and he started really bad, ended pretty well. His son Ammon was just a bad apple and the rest of them were a bad apple. And so in the 580s, Babylon came and conquered, and at that point it was Jehoiakim, and they exiled them to Babylon. And so when it says the captives of Judah, that's what he's talking about. All right, history lesson over. All right, and so Arioch comes in and says, hey, I found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. And so Arioch hurries Daniel to the king, not only because the king's matter is urgent, but probably also because lives are at stake. And so he comes running into the king, and what's interesting is the way in which he approaches the king. And his comment to the king sort of denies knowledge of Daniel's previous conversation with the king regarding extra time. In those days, it would have been a death sentence for Arioch not to have carried out the wishes of the king. So perhaps Arioch is pretending to have not known that Daniel came and spoke to the king, even though he was kind of the one that orchestrated it. And so instead, he comes in, he's like, hey, king, I found this guy, and this guy can tell you your dream. Kudos to me, right? And so perhaps he's trying to gain the king's favor by kind of feigning some ignorance here. We just got to keep in mind, it's all bureaucracy, it's all politics in Babylon. But the king knows Daniel, and so he kind of just ignores Arioch and kind of gets right to the point. And so we see in verse 26, that the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? Hey, did you do it? Did you do what we talked about? Did you figure it out? And of course, we know that it was God who had done it for Daniel. But in this case, the king is not addressing God, but Daniel. And that's an important distinction to make because Daniel's going to address the fact that Nebuchadnezzar is asking him if he did it. It says, verse 27, then Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king hath demanded cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king. Hey, what you asked for is impossible. You asked me if I did it. No, I didn't do it. It can't be done. He says, but, verse 28, first part, but there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Hey, what you've asked for is impossible for men. And this is important, king. What I'm about to tell you is not from me. It's from my God, who is the only one that can do what you've asked for. The wise man can't do it. The Babylonian gods can't do it. I can't do it. My friends can't do it. But God can do it. And so what I'm about to reveal to you, king, is not from me. It's from my God, and that's important. You asked me if I did it. I didn't do it. God did it. And so he continues, thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. He gets right to the dream. He says, As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed what should come to pass hereafter. And he that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. And so here's what your dream was about. Your dream was about what's going to happen next. And so the contents of your dream are a sort of prophetic timeline of what's going to happen. He says, verse 30, but as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. He says, hey, and here's how the dream relates to me. The dream is not to make me look good and to show my skill. That's what the other wise men wanted to do. He says, but the dream and my role in the dream is simply to kind of be the mouth of God to show you what your dream means. And I do believe that this confession of selflessness really helps to aid to the credibility of what he's going to say. You know, the wise men were all about making things sound good for the prestige, and the king knew it. But Daniel tells him up front, I'm not here buttering you up to try to make you feel good. I'm just the mouthpiece of God to tell you what's coming next. And so the message was good. And so Daniel's going to reveal it. But first, he has to fulfill the first part of the demand. And he has to tell the king what the dream was So here it is. And from here on out, we're going to move a little more quickly. He says, "Thou, O king, sawest and behold a great image," or a great statue. And this great image, or this great statue, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. Now, that doesn't mean bad. That means, like, awesome, right? Full of awe, right? And this is just this. So here's this great big statue, king, and the statue is just, it's huge, and it's wonderful, and it's great, and it's fear-inducing, right? Because any good king wants to strike fear into the heart of his enemies, right? He says, "The image's head," or the statue's head, "was of fine gold, and his breast and his arms," or his upper torso, "of silver, his belly and his thighs," his lower torso, "of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part iron, part of iron, and part of clay." And so here's this statue, and the different segments of the statue are comprised of different materials of decreasing value. He says, "Thou sawest till a stone was cut out without hands." And so out of nowhere, here comes this stone. And the stone smote the image upon his feet that were part of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And so this stone comes out of nowhere, breaks the feet, and once the feet are broken, the rest of it just kind of disintegrates and floats away. All right? "And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." And so after this statue is broken into pieces, that stone that smites it stays there and grows to this mountain that ends up filling the entire earth. All right? And he says, "This is the dream." All right, dream, I told you the dream. That's what you dreamed. And Nebuchadnezzar's like, "Yeah, that is what I dreamed." He goes, "And now here's what it means. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king." He says, "Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory." He says, king, you are to be the greatest king, human king, that's ever existed. And it's going to be that way because God has determined it to be that way. He says, you are a king of kings because God, who is the king of heaven, has given you your kingdom and your power and your strength and your glory. He says, "And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand and hath made thee ruler over them all." He says, "Thou art this head of gold." And so he says, king, the head that you saw of gold, that's you. You're the head of gold. And unfortunately, when we get to Daniel chapter 3, we're going to see that Nebuchadnezzar completely misunderstood what Daniel was saying. And so, spoiler alert on that. But Daniel tells King Nebuchadnezzar that he is to be the greatest king of the greatest human empire that would ever exist. And he says, and his kingdom is far-reaching, right? Wherever the children of men dwell, God has made you the ruler over them all, right? He says, you're the head of gold. "And after you shall arise another kingdom," another empire, but this one's going to be inferior to you. "And another third kingdom of brass," even more inferior, "which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise." And so Daniel is telling Nebuchadnezzar, what you've dreamed about is all of the world empires that are going to exist. It's going to start with Babylon, which is going to be the first world empire. And next is going to come, anybody know? The Medo-Persian Empire, which is to be inferior to Babylon. And then after that comes Bronze, which is Greece, right? And then after Greece comes Rome, right? And Rome is this very violent empire, and he hints at that when he says, as iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And so he's prophesying these different world empires, and then he gets to number 5. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay, and as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And so what he's talking about, you got the iron, but also the clay, he's talking about a revived Roman Empire that will be partly strong, but partly broken. And so what he's talking about is the end times. He's talking about eschatology. He's talking about when the Antichrist comes, and the Antichrist is going to be the leader of a revived Roman Empire, right? And so four of these world kingdoms have already existed, and the fifth one is yet to come for us here in 2025. And so he says, and whereas thou sawest that iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And so it's going to be a kingdom of division, and then ultimately it's going to be broken apart, which we'll get to in a minute. And so Daniel makes this prophetic interpretation, and then he makes a really interesting prophecy as kind of a commentary on the interpretation. He says, and in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. This is that stone, right? And if you'll recall, when we looked at the parable of, I don't remember which parable it was. I was just listening to this in my scripture reading like the last couple days, where it talks about the stone which the builders rejected. And it says, whoever falls on it will be broken, but on whoever it falls, they will be crushed, right? That stone refers to Jesus Christ, the Messiah. He says, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. All right, and it's important that we talk about this, because this is why, this passage is why, when Jesus the Messiah shows up, everyone thinks he's there to overthrow Rome. Everyone thinks he's there to set up a physical kingdom. Right? There's a human meaning here, but there's also a divine meaning. God is going to overthrow Rome, but not yet. And so the divine fulfillment has already taken place at Christ's first coming, but the literal fulfillment has not yet taken place. It will take place at his second coming. And so when he says that he's going to set up this kingdom, and this kingdom is going to consume, and this kingdom, this mountain, is going to fill all the earth, what he's talking about is he's talking about salvation and the establishment of the church. He's talking about a spiritual kingdom that Christ set up when he came to this earth. And it's a kingdom that permeates and transcends every tribe, every tongue, every culture, every nation, right? And this takes place during the first four empires. And so even in Daniel chapter 2, God is setting up his kingdom. Right? He's using Daniel in the kingdom of Babylon. And he's going to use Daniel and Ezra and Nehemiah during the Medo-Persian Empire. And then when you get to Greece and Rome, that's when you've got like the intertestamental period with like the Maccabees and some of those other guys. And then you get to Jesus, and Jesus comes on scene during Rome. And so during the period of these first four empires, God is setting up his kingdom. But it's not a physical kingdom, it's a spiritual kingdom. And it's a kingdom that permeates and transcends every tribe, tongue, culture, and nation. We are all the family of God. That's why we call them our brothers and sisters in Nigeria, and our brothers and sisters in Japan. you know, when we went to France for a mission trip, that was Kate's first time out of the country. That was her first missions trip. I'd been to France once before. Of course, I grew up in Japan. But I asked her, I said, what are you most excited about for this missions trip? And of course, you know, she was all excited about the patisseries, you know, and the pastries and the cheese and the sights. And she was excited about all that. But you know what she told me she was most excited about? She said, I'm most excited to see the churches. And I want to see how the gospel and what the gospel is doing in France. And she said, you know, I know that in France, their churches are a little bit different, like not only just language-wise, but you know, there are other differences. And she said, I really want to get a broader view of how the church operates. And we're all the family of God. And so God has set up this kingdom and God has set up this family, and it's a spiritual kingdom, but there is coming a time where Christ is going to come back and he's going to set up a literal kingdom. And he is going to literally overthrow the Antichrist and a revived Roman Empire. And at the final battle of Revelation 20, God is going to destroy the Antichrist. He's going to set up a new heaven, a new earth, and he's going to set up a kingdom that will last forever. And this event, coupled with the Great White Throne Judgment, is going to usher in eternity, the rest of time. And so this is a profound eschatological prophecy that God has given to Nebuchadnezzar and to Daniel in this dream. And Daniel continues in verse 45. We're almost done. He says, "For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof, sure." Daniel concludes his interpretation and assures the king that the matter is settled and it will come to pass. And so that's the dream and that's the interpretation. And in verses 46 and 47, we see Nebuchadnezzar's response. "Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshiped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him," literally a sacrifice, right? Those who have had heart ablations know that they go in and they kind of sear and burn, right? And so the idea of oblate is to burn, right? And so this is this offering, the sacrifice. And it says, "And the king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord or a master of kings, and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldst reveal this secret." All right, Daniel, you're the real deal. Those other guys, they're a bunch of fakers, but you're the real deal because you have a relationship with a God who transcends all these Babylonian gods. And unfortunately, Nebuchadnezzar hasn't quite wrapped his head around that truth. It's going to be a couple more years before he really gets that settled. But his confession here is a great confession. Daniel, you're the real deal. And it's not because of who you are, it's because of who your God is. Your God is a God of gods. He's a Lord or a master of kings. He's a revealer of secrets. And I know this because he showed you this secret. And then we read in verse 48, "Then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. Then Daniel requested of the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego," his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, those are their Hebrew names. He requested of the king, and the king set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. And so he made them governors. All right, Daniel says, "Hey, king, would you make my friends governors of Babylon?" And the king says, "Sure," and makes them governors of Babylon, but Daniel, he sat in the gate of the king. And so his three friends, they are governors over Babylon, and that's important because when we get to chapter 3 and we read about this little statue that the king sets up in the Valley of Shinar, that's going to be important. But Daniel, he's sitting in the gate of the king. And so whereas his three friends are governors over the province, Daniel himself is a direct advisor to the greatest king of the greatest empire, humanly speaking, that has ever existed. And so we're going to leave off there, and we'll pick up chapter 3 next week. But there's a couple of takeaways, a couple of things that I want us to note before we get to our discussion questions. Number one, like Daniel, we need to keep our focus on God. He is the source of our wisdom and ability. The things that we're doing for God, they're not us. They're Him in us. And so when it comes to our service for God, when it comes to navigating the trials of life and knowing what to do and how to do it, we need to keep our focus on God. You know, Sonia has shared several times one of her favorite passages was it Jehoshaphat that said, "Lord, we don't know what to do, but our eyes are on you." All right? And so we need to keep our focus on God because He is the source of our wisdom and ability. Two, we need to understand that God is the sovereign ruler of the earth and all human rulers are appointed by Him. And so when it comes to the way that we interact with human leaders, whether it's governmental or even within the church, when it comes to the way that we interact with human leadership, we need to realize that all human leadership is in one way or another appointed by God. And so we need to keep that in mind. And then the third thing that we need to keep in mind is that we need to recognize that God wins in the end. You know, things, at least at the beginning, and even throughout here, you know, things in Babylon seem very touch and go, right? And it seems like there's always something threatening Daniel and his friends. But God's in control. And when the Persians show up, same thing. There's always something that seems to threaten to undo us or to undo Daniel and his friends. But God's in control. And when Greece comes on the scene and when Rome comes on the scene, right, things seem really bleak, right? And Rome was a time of profound persecution for believers. I mean, remember this guy named Nero? He's a pretty awful guy. And he did some pretty awful things to Christians. But we need to understand that God wins in the end. And even in our world today, all around the world, you know, I don't think we as Americans really understand what it means to suffer for Jesus. We really, you know, pretty much the extent of our persecution is that people are mean to us. And as a nation, America really has been spared in a lot of ways from having to endure persecution of Christians. But that's not the case around the world. And there are countries all around the world where Christians are being persecuted, Christians are being put in prison, they're being tortured, they're being executed. There's a movie called Tortured for Christ. And I'm blanking on the guy's name right now. I want to say Richard Wurmbrand, but that does not, I don't think that's it. But he talks about when he was captured and imprisoned in the Soviet Union. Is it Richard Wurmbrand? Do I have that? Okay. And he talks about how he was beaten. And he said he said, you know, we were told that we weren't allowed to preach, and if we preached, they were going to beat us. And he said it actually worked out pretty well because we wanted to preach and they wanted to beat us, and so we both won. And I don't know that I would have had that same perspective, but around the world, Christians are persecuted and tortured and executed for their faith. And that's a pretty bleak reality, but we need to understand that in the end, God wins. And so we serve a king who has already assured the victory. He has already set up his spiritual kingdom. It's a kingdom that permeates the entire world, and it ain't going anywhere. And someday he's going to come, and he's going to set up his physical kingdom. And his physical kingdom, unlike Babylon, which eventually ended, and the Medo-Persian Empire, which eventually ended, and the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire that eventually ended, and the revived Roman Empire, which is eventually going to end, unlike those empires, God's kingdom, God's physical kingdom, once it is established, it's not going anywhere, and it will be here for eternity. And so we need to understand that God wins in the end. And all of this is in view in Nebuchadnezzar's dream of Daniel chapter 2.